Hello, my friends. Today we are talking to Nick, the CEO at Wrangle, and we discuss cultivating alignment as a leader, the factors that determine a successful proof of concept, and what enterprises can do to better prioritize performance. All of this right here, right now on the Modern CTO Podcast.
Here we go.
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
How are you feeling today? You feeling good? It's Friday.
I feel pretty good. The days sort of blend into each other. So Friday's good, but yeah, Saturday I'll be here again. So
are you at home? Are you going to the office? What are you up to?
I'm at home. That is a picture of my office. So it just looks better than my other background.
I love it, man. I get really excited especially when I get to talk to CEOs that are in the technology space, because you know, you get the entrepreneurial aspect of growing something and doing difficult things. I'm a big fan of doing difficult things. So what is Wrangle?
So Wrangle is a modern innovation and development company, consultancy. And we're a little unique in that we were born in the sort of the modern customer experience era. So we're going to be 7 years old in about a week. And I started the company in May 2013 when I got really excited about HTML5, mobile, responsive web, like a whole rewriting of the web. And our first tagline was the web inverted, because after a decade or longer working with companies, helping them move everything to the server, and web-based application architecture and thin client, we were going in the exact opposite direction. We're building thick clients. We're going back to client server because browsers have gotten so popular that they created a much better experience if you built the application to run in the browser. And that was where Wrangle started. And we jumped in right when it started taking off. So we were, as far as I know, the first JavaScript only web development consultancy in North America, because nobody actually could build full applications with using just JavaScript like 6 months before from a practical perspective. And from a market timing perspective, it was really about the distribution channel. So, JavaScript had been around for a decade, mobile was taking off, but everything always had to be supporting older browsers. And with HTML5 and Chrome driving a standards compliance level that we've never seen in the world, really, from an open source perspective, that started creating these open source platforms and the ability to start building these new applications. So the way I sort of described it is that I think around January, February 2013, the number of devices that were running pretty much HTML5 compliant type browsers was over 90%. And once that happened, you no longer had to go through these hoops and build server-side applications. And with mobile and the rewriting of the web, that was really the start for Wrangle. And we got there early, and we just have kept evolving with that and bringing in new capabilities. So we started in the era of mobile, responsive, HTML5, and where Agile had become an accepted way of building things, which was also new because Agile as a practice never really got very far in the services world because of the way contracts were normally done and the way companies work. So we also started when Agile also crossed a certain threshold. So we've never been anything but Agile in our history. And that's resulted in our evolution to this modern digital consultancy that's focused on customer experience, lean agile practices, and the ability to scale digital in a way that is just different because we don't have any legacy sort of built into our DNA.
I really like the brand. I checked out the website. I like the style of the brand. I also like how you guys had the navigation organized about like who we are and like about us, like what we think that the structure and the substructure was actually very human in its exploration, right? You could tell that there was a lot of intelligence behind how you structured it, because those are the questions that people are asking. They're the most popular pages on our site is the about site about page. Yeah.
Yeah, and we tried to build the website to reflect our purpose and what we do for our clients. And it's evolved a lot over the years. But one of the interesting things about what we do is we partner with our clients in a transparent manner. So when you're working in a very accelerated agile fashion, you're effectively, we do continuous delivery all the time, and we're always delivering to the clients, which means that the conversation and the relationship is much more at the point of work being created. So it's not in the deliverables, it's in the interactions around the deliverables. So we start building something for a client, and we partner with a continuous delivery model, and they know everything that's going on all the time. All of our people are client facing. And as a result, we've got a very strong symmetry with what we do and what our clients do and want to do. Our client value proposition, our brand to our clients, is the same to the people that join Wrangle. There's a unique symmetry there, which is one of the reasons we were able to grow fast when we were, you know, from a start 7 years ago to about 200 people today, is that symmetry. And we've kept continuously evolved as the industry's evolved and stayed ahead of it, so that we've become the scaled digital customer experience consultancy and transformation partner for our clients.
Are you guys doing a lot of proof of concepts?
We are doing, in some respects, our model is that everything should be something you learn from. So proof of concept is in the continuous delivery model. We do a lot of exploratory work. We do a lot of proof of concepts. We do a lot of MVP work. So we worked with one large global medical company where the model was POCs, MVPs, and then scaling and market. And one of the reasons for that wasn't just about finding the market and finding the concepts, but for internal organizational alignment. There's nothing quite like trying to get something done to get to find out where the friction is and find out where the alignment needs to come.
So I got a question for you. So my background, I've been engineering for 17 years. And one of the conversations that I've had with a couple different people were they, I guess, discussing the topic of, if you're building an MVP or, you know, proof of concept, some people say it's okay to be really lazy with the code and rack up a ton of technical debt. Other people say there's no reason why you shouldn't do best practices from day one. What are your thoughts on this topic?
I'd say it's like everything, it depends. It always depends on what the context is. So if you really are proving something out and there's a high, you know, amount of uncertainty, then throwaway code can be useful. But well, what we found is as we work in a certain way we do high quality code, we test our code, even in shorter projects, that tends to deliver more value because it's forcing you to think better and you're building faster because you can think better about your code and you can explore more. So it's, I think that line where writing high quality tested code, where it used to be, I would say maybe, you know, you're 6 weeks into a project and you've got three people and you're going to continue to work on it. You want to make sure that you're doing your testing and the high quality code. I think with everybody being really good at it and the way that it drives thinking and evolution of a code base, I'd say if you're doing something that you expect may continue on, start with the high quality, because the challenge is if you've incurred too much technical debt, it becomes very, very hard to recover from that, particularly early on. One thing we found when we were working with clients early on, so when AngularJS, one of the technologies that, you know, we kicked off with as a, you know, the world's sort of first, you know, AngularJS consultancy, one of the first, when people didn't think about quality until they were 6 weeks in, then they didn't know how to do it anymore. The code wasn't really amenable to refactoring it, because quality comes from, you know, really clean code, decoupled code, things you can think about it. It's been challenged continuously, which testing does. And you get too far in and you never recover. So I would say that if you think you're going to go past 2 weeks, then I'd say go all in on the quality.
How do you approach, like, determining if these proof of concepts, like you build a proof of concept for something, maybe a client, like how do you determine its success?
Everyone has a different goal when they build something. And there's a different number of assumptions. So the first thing is to really understand what the proof of concept's for. And often people have a high level of enthusiasm for an idea, but the idea that they're really enthusiastic about is down in the future. And it's very hard to get there. So if you're going to build something really, really effective and find a way to market from a lean startup product market fit perspective, you have to understand where you're trying to go in the short term, because it's like sailing a boat. And if a proof of concept is going to prove something could be sort of done in a useful way, that's a user experience outcome. If you're trying to see if it's going to attract a potential client, then you need something that's going to go into market and see if you can actually attract users. So success really depends on the hypothesis, and having people who think about product from a business value perspective and can, you know, come up with those that sort of incremental iterative value that you're going to deliver and measure against. And if you can knock out, you know, different hypotheses, business ones, as you move through, then your initial POCs lay the foundation for building a product MVP. So you've eliminated a lot of the risk and you found enough to prioritize. And then every single increment should be a clarification of something. And that's where a lot of innovation breaks down, because there's not the ongoing sort of hunger to learn and evolve. It becomes, okay, someone's decided this, we're just going to build it. And it turns into a feature race, and there's not that sort of evolution.
So you're several years into this business. I want to know, like, what's keeping you excited? Why are you getting out of bed in the morning still?
Yeah, software is an incredibly rewarding but difficult profession. So, you know, I've been in the field for over 20 years now, and the amount of things that we build that are wasted, and the things that are speculative, and the things that, you know, that is a huge human cost. And building better software and finding ways of building better software, so we're not always restarting and we're creating things that deliver more value. The better value we can deliver, the more value we can deliver, it's a better world we make. So my passion for software and digital, you know, building, it comes from that. And there's still so much, so far to go in terms of, you know, our industry and our practices, in terms of innovation and, you know, transformation and customer experience. And there's so many industries that are, you know, need to evolve into digital centric businesses that, you know, for me, the journey is only just starting.
That's exciting. What makes you tick, like personal hobbies when you're not doing the company or building the software empire? What are you doing?
So that's a bit of an area of, shame, I guess. Building a company is really, really hard. So, you know, I did wake up one day and realize I wasn't really talking to my friends. I didn't have any hobbies, wasn't doing anything for fun. You know, spent a lot of time with my kids, which is great. And, you know, they're getting older now. But yeah, I wasn't really taking care of myself that well. And I've tried to improve that in the last year. So still hard, because there's obviously, with, you know, COVID-19, there's a huge focus on business. But I started teaching myself piano about a year ago as a hobby.
Nice.
And you know, there's a couple of things that I've learned, and you know, one is having a hobby is great, because it just spins your brain in a different direction and acquiring other skills, because it's easy to fall into a trap, especially as an entrepreneur and, you know, CEO, that, you know, you're constantly trying to have the right answers, and you know, you never do. It's always changing. The market's always changing. And so to continuously stay learning and not get trapped and becoming too operational. And I think that's a personal, that's where companies, you know, start to be challenged, because they become all about the operating and the risk management and the efficiencies. And you can become the same as a person, and then you burn out. You know, you don't find joy in the work. And so I found that by maintaining more discipline, I can maintain my enthusiasm, and it doesn't go away, because if you actually pay attention and you learn and you read and you, you know, especially the really brilliant stuff that's coming out, it just never stops. There's always something amazing to do next and try to build and innovate. Just when you get stuck in your own head, that it seems like it's getting dusty.
Do you ever follow Jocko or David Goggins?
I read all of those books. I'm not following the podcast, but yeah, Extreme Leadership, Dichotomy of Leadership, both incredible books. Particularly, I love the Dichotomy of Leadership because...
Is that Goggins?
No, that's Jocko.
I didn't see... I only read his ownership one, his like Extreme Ownership one. I didn't know he had a second one.
Well, the second book was a bit of a mea culpa because people got carried away with Extreme Ownership and a lot of people interpreted it as sort of micromanagement, and that's not what it is. You own the outcome and you're there to create, you know, the team and the systems that the outcome happens, but you're not creating the outcome. You're creating the environment. And so they wrote the Dichotomy of Leadership because everything is on a spectrum, and they talk about, you know, sometimes you should micromanage. Sometimes you should let people run. And, you know, you see this a lot, especially with new managers. It's like, I like to empower my people. And it's like, well, you just let them fuck up all the time. Excuse my language. But, you know, they don't know how to do the job yet. So let's see a little micromanagement until you've given them the knowledge to do the job. Andy Grove captured that really well in High Output Management, where he talked about task relevant maturity. You can take someone who's brilliant in one job. That doesn't mean they're brilliant in the other. They're suddenly junior again. And you have to evolve everybody in a new role, particularly in a, you know, in an organization that's scaling. So, but yeah. And I read David Goggins' book a couple of months ago. So
I didn't know he had a book. I just follow him on YouTube. I'll check his book out.
Yeah, there's a generation gap showing up there. I'm reading all the books, and most of the people that work at Wrangle, it's like, you know, I asked someone what book that they learned, you know, JavaScript from, and they looked at me like I was like, book? It's like, you learn everything on the internet, dude. It's like, and it's like, I guess that's pretty true, right? So,
yeah, I do a lot of Audible, and then I'll follow like a couple different people's podcasts that, like, I'll follow people who interview great people, and then that way that gives me my. And then I'll run off into a corner, like consume all of like this person's content, and then come back to like the Joe Rogan podcast, listen to him interview more great people, and then go follow down into another hole. And that's kind of the pattern I've noticed myself getting into.
Yeah. So in, you know, for whatever strange reason, like the last 2 years, it seems every book on leadership I read has some chapter on the Navy SEALs. Like it almost has to be there. So I read or Special Forces. So the you know, the Extreme Ownership, great book. I read all of the General Stanley McChrystal books, Team of Teams, One Mission, which are fabulous from actually looking at modern digital organizations, because it's about how fast can you respond in a complex environment where things are shifting all the time. And it's a great definition of, you know, what happens in lean startup and what happens in modern development. And it's a team of teams model. And it talks about how problems that emerge at a cross-functional level can only be solved at a cross-functional level. And typical organizational hierarchies, everything escalates up and down, but you lose so much information and context that if you have three different groups escalating up, everyone at the top tries to solve the problem and they invariably make it worse. So how do you solve those kind of organizational challenges? And they do a really good job of articulating that in the McChrystal's books.
Oh, thanks. I think I saw it on my Audible, that Teams of Teams book cover, I think yesterday or the day before. And I was like, oh, that's actually pretty cool. Cause I talk a lot about like autonomous team scaling and structure, and Team of Teams is like, that's the most perfect succinct title ever, right?
It's a great book too, because most books that are written, they're usually written early on, and they're written to talk about something new. So they have that consulting, for lack of a better word, sort of lack of depth, and they don't really get into the hard human bits. And what I liked about Team of Teams is it goes into a lot of the hard human bits, and there's a lot of just exploration of all the dark corners where things fail. And they talk a lot about that. And One Mission does a similar thing. So it's they do as good a job as I've seen from a lean agile perspective, an agile transformation, digital transformation, in illuminating the shadows of the dark corners where the friction comes and the failures come, and what kind of investment and efforts required to overcome that.
Speaking of this, I'm curious about like health, wellness. I recently started getting into that. And I was looking at a couple different wearables. They've got rings, they've got straps. Have you ever experimented with any of the wearables?
Yeah, I have. Apple Watch, pretty much, for the most part. I got really into that for a while. I still use it. I find having some feedback mechanisms is helpful. So from staying on top of things. And it's pretty incredible. I didn't even realize how deep it went until I started seeing what I could measure. And it turned out pretty much everything. So I got a little carried away. I did. That got me a little thinking about it too much. So I did for a while, and that was interesting. The ability for the trackers to be accurate is a little questionable. So after I did that for a while, and that was great. Then I started just using on iOS. It actually tracks your sleep for you pretty much if you turn on the bedtime thing. And it just notes how long you haven't moved your phone for. And that's actually been what I've been doing lately. So on a weekly basis, I make sure I hit a certain threshold, because I did discover by sleep tracking that I actually slept. I was overestimating how much I slept by about 45 minutes a day. I just sort of assumed I was sleeping like, you know, seven and a half hours a day. And when I actually started tracking and I looked at the data, I was clocking in at six and three quarters. So it's given me a little more discipline to pay attention. And that's been actually very impactful from a health perspective.
Yeah, I was using this sleep tracking app that was pretty good, but it listens to your movements, you know, when you're sleeping. But then in my experimentation as a scientist, right, I was thinking, you know, trying different things, and I tried the sound machine, you know, to sleep, and that actually negates the thing. So I fell back to the bedtime feature that you were talking about, which it's accurate. The other thing was more accurate, but I sleep better with the sound machine now. And and so it's just, it's like you said, you know, you kind of get into it a little bit, you play with it a little bit, you figure out if it's something you want to, how deep you want to go down the rabbit hole. But yeah, I haven't gotten any of the straps. I haven't gotten the watch. I was looking at this other strap. I can't remember what it was called, but it was like $180. And then there was a ring called Aurora. I remember what the ring was called, but it was like a Go strap or something. I don't know. But I was looking at a couple different ones, thinking, you know, what would it be like if I had something strapped to my wrist? My wife has the Apple Watch. And I was just asking around, seeing what other people thought of them.
Yeah, it's... I find it interesting, because I didn't wear a watch for years. And then I bought the Apple Watch because what really got me to buy it at first, I was interested in the voice feature. So by being able to have a sort of a voice, you know, thing strapped to your wrist, I was wondering how useful that would be from a user experience perspective. It turns out it's still it's not the best for rapid voice recognition. So that gave me some insight into that. And then I wanted to decouple from my phone. So I sort of thought it'd be interesting to just be able to leave my phone behind and not always be carrying it around. And then once I started wearing the watch for a while, now I just feel weird when I don't wear it. So so now I just wear it all the time because it's become a habit.
And, so it's stuck. You like the watch?
Yeah, I love the watch. I feel weird when I'm not wearing it now.
Yeah, my wife got the watch and it's stuck, and she's been wearing it for a year now, and she really likes it too.
Yeah. I also did a few other things, like, so from a measurement thing. So if you wear it when you sleep, your best time to sort of measure your resting heart rate is just before you get out of bed. So you automatically get your resting heart rate. That's a strong predictor for mortality and general sort of, you know, cardio health. So that's a pretty good one. I bought a blood pressure machine that syncs up with the phone. So now if I go into Apple Health, I've got my cardio, I've got my meditation, I've got my resting heart rate, I've got my blood pressure, I've got my sleep. And so all of a sudden it's pretty compelling. And I don't have to look at it all the time. Like even if, say, at the end of the month on Sunday mornings, I can just sort of flick through it and see how I'm doing, because I'm not actively thinking about any of those things. It's just all being aggregated.
Have you gotten any actual, like, actionable insights? Like, if I don't eat, 3 hours before bed, I sleep better? Or have you gotten anything from the data?
Not so much. I didn't drink any alcohol for 10 weeks before Christmas. I took off 10 weeks and my resting heart rate went down a little bit. That was one measure. And that was the only discernible sort of measure I got. I didn't see any difference in my sleep patterns or anything.
Have you ever gotten a food sensitivity test?
No.
Okay, so get this. So my stepmom and my dad, they own this clinic called Peaks of Health. And I saw them, start it. And then over the past 5 years, it's grown really big. I see it just keep growing really big and really fast. And so eventually I was like, what do you guys do there? why is it growing so fast? Why is it doing so well? And they're like, well, we do personalized, individualized, health, medicine. And it's not insurance. It's you just go and you pay cash. And so I said, well, I'll check it out. And they had these food sensitivity test. And I spent $600 and got 96 foods checked, right? So they drew a ton of blood and I got the results back. And it was I was 50% allergic to my entire diet. And just so you know, I wake up, I go for a run, I eat 2 eggs, no junk on them, 2 pieces of whole wheat organic toast, and a protein bar. And then I'm just a very clean, organic type person, right? Because I used to be 300 pounds. I used to be really big. So I got these habits from not wanting to do that. And so I was like, well, this is unbelievable. What would happen if I'm having these immune responses and these allergen responses that they can tell from the antibodies in my blood? What would happen if I changed my diet? And so I did. And I felt just enormous amounts better. Significantly more energy, within 48 hours of eliminating these items from my diet. What we found was there was one food. What was happening is there's one food that was a wheat reaction, a wheat sensitivity, mm-hmm. and that created this thing called leaky gut. And so what happened is I'd eat this whole grain wheat, right? Really, really natural and everything. And my body would have a small reaction to it, although I couldn't physically pick up on it, right? And then that would create this issue where things would leak from my gut into my bloodstream, and then my body would start attacking those things as foreign bodies. So it basically takes your entire diet and turns it against you.
Wow. Yeah, I've read a bit about that.
It is very real. I'll tell you, there are handfuls of things, there's all this health stuff all the time, right? But this was a very, very real thing. So they put me on an 18-month plan to seal up my gut. And I'll tell you what, just within 48 hours of, you have to find the origin food that's causing the leaky gut problem, completely eliminate that. And then even though those other foods, you still have to completely cycle your diet again to completely different foods, wait 18 months, and then now it's fixed. You never go back to the food that caused the problem, and then you can go back on your normal diet. And this whole process I've gone through, it's not a one doctor visit thing. It's been this 6-month thing I've been going through. But I will tell you this, it completely changed my available amounts of energy and my life, my sleep quality, and all of that, far more impact than all of the small things I'd done in my fitness life up until this point. So I've been recommending it to people now, spend the couple $100, get the food sensitivity test, get 96 foods or a high number of foods, and then just check. Because if I would have talked to my past self 6 months ago, I'd be like, dude, I feel fine. There are days when I have more energy, there are days when I have less energy, because it's relative to you, right?
Yeah.
And so there would have been no way to really convince myself, but I don't know, it's just something that I'm gonna figure out a better way to talk about it in the future. This is actually my first time talking about it with you today. I've never talked about this on the podcast before, but it's just made such a difference in my life that I'm encouraging people now to go get food immune response and allergy response test.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've never thought of getting that done. So I have my health regime is doing intermittent fasting. So I'm a little trendy on that. So noon to 8 p.m. And I take a bit of omega-3, vitamin D, a little bit of magnesium, and then I'm done. So
I like the magnesium too. I take that before bed. It helps me sleep.
That actually does seem to help a little bit. So the magnesium.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about the company stuff. One of the things I am curious about is, you know, there's always different configurations of how your teams will interface with your customers. What does your company do? Like, how do they go work at their offices? Do they, like, what's your style?
So we put together teams that work mostly out of the Wrangell office. So we built our culture working face to face with our teammates because of the sort of the agile, lean agile principles that we're building the company around. And then we use a continuous delivery model to partner with our clients. So we set up a CDCI pipeline. We integrate into our clients' infrastructure. And then we work with their stakeholders, ideally a product owner on the client side. And we put together elite sort of high performing teams, and we build out customer experiences, and we deliver rapidly, and we work with the client to remove the blockers that get in the way. So, and we're so used to delivering fast and the continuous delivery model, it's been an interesting experience. So as we partner with different clients, they traditionally have the siloed waterfall process. Even if they ostensibly have agile delivery on their technology teams, it's really incremental delivery, you know, from a technology perspective, but there's no agility across the rest of the organization. When you're trying to move faster, and we work in 1 week iterations, and you're working cross-functionally, and you're trying to ship all the time, you're pushing against the organizational boundaries. And what we've done over the years is we've just constantly tried to build out the capabilities to remove more and more of the blockers so that we can continue to deliver in a continuous delivery, fast, you know, manner. And we measure cycle time as whether we're being successful or not. So our cultural sort of norms are high quality, cross-functional, low cycle time, where we're trying to, you know, define and ship features in under 3 days. And then solving all of the organizational sort of needs around that, so we can do that with any organization.
I like that. What are your best customers look like?
Usually there's a alignment, so they have a strong commitment to agile transformation, but they're usually in earlier stages because that's almost a near impossible task in a large company. And digital transformation now is the, sort of the next wave. We do a lot of work with you know, Fortune 500 companies, a lot of global retailers, financial services companies, banks, insurance companies. We also do a lot of work with startups as well. We try to maintain a balanced portfolio so we don't get stuck and you know, lose our sort of lean agile roots and the cultural norms of high quality, sort of fast, you know, innovative delivery. So we've worked with, because we started in the technology space, one of the unique things about us is our clients have been pretty global from early on. So we have a large client in Japan. We have a large client in Europe. Canada is actually a very small percentage of our clients. The majority of our business has been in the United States over the last 6 years. And we're able to reach that market because of our focus in our core discipline. So we're well known in the JavaScript community. We're well known, you know, for what we do, and we're able to reach into those different communities.
When you work with the enterprises today, because that is part of your portfolio, what do you notice that they're doing as far as like performance and prioritization?
The shift that we're seeing now, and this has been we've worked with I think four of our clients for about 4 years now. And so we've seen their evolution over the time period, and things that were not norms or accepted or even understood are now quite well understood. So we've always taken a position of doing everything at the best practices and really developing those capabilities. So we very early on, we would put actual experienced Scrum Masters on projects. The vast majority of our clients didn't think that was really that necessary because they already had project managers, or they put people on a course for a couple of days, or they had somebody who knew how to sort of schedule stand-ups in the calendar, but there was no understanding of the dynamics of cross-functional team creation, nurturing, you know, coaching, doing retrospectives, continuous improvement, and all those things that get a team working together as one and sort of creating more value. And that shifted. So like as of say about 12 months ago, yeah, and these are some clients that we've been working with. So I like to think that we've had a an influence, but these are large organizations. I can see that, you know, as I think digital transformation, agile transformation with large companies, you know, everyone plans to do it in 3 years, but it takes like 15 because there are so many cultural and organizational challenges that take a while to become generally understood in the industry. And once they're generally understood in the industry, now the next time, like the third or fourth time you try to do a change management initiative within the organization, it actually takes because the common knowledge, the zeitgeist, if you will, around how to run a digital team is the common understanding is now closer to the end goal. So you see people actually getting experienced Scrum Masters, and they exist now too, which is another thing, right? It takes multiple turns to actually produce the talent and the leadership. You see a product focus. You see companies moving to persistent funding. With scaled agile, the actual practices which were wildly inconsistent 2 years ago are starting to become pretty good, and there's a lot more traction happening. So now I think we're getting to that next stage where it's it's going to be really interesting on what companies do next, because the cross-functional sort of end-to-end innovation capabilities of companies is still a huge lift. It's still a big journey because companies are still optimized for functions.
Do you have any projects that you're particularly excited about that you could talk about?
I guess that's always challenging. I can't speak specifically for most of our clients, but I can say that we worked with a large medical device company, and we've done HIPAA compliant medical device software development in a purely agile fashion and got it through regulatory approval and in market. And that was an incredible journey and an amazing commitment from the client and a huge learning sort of experience and what it takes to be able to do something. And a good example, like if there's a strong enough commitment to achieving an outcome, people are very industrious. And if there's enough motivation to stay the course and actually get something done, you get through that change. And that was pretty profound. We've seen a lot of our clients start to get pretty adept at doing scaled agile, so safe PI planning. And what's been really interesting for us is, because we roll up with high functioning sort of agile cross-functional teams and we work in a continuous delivery model, we don't really find a lot of difference in different scaled agile practices because we have our own sort of model and our own instincts, and it's really built into our culture. But what we would find is you roll in and everything is just the old practices being done in new sort of forms, and the teams would struggle a lot because there wasn't any appreciation for the quality of the requirements going into the team and creating a decision space for the team, any autonomy. It was functional specs being chopped into user stories, the ability to remove problems or get service level agreements across different functions wasn't there, common understanding was missing. And so the friction was there. There'd be these teams that were agile that just couldn't move things through the organization. And that's where a lot of the respect came for our teams, is because we just kept things moving. We're very sort of committed to shipping. It's sort of like you ship high quality things frequently, and we just keep churning at it and sort of provide some of the energy for the change management. And then the organizations do change and they do evolve. And what I saw last year was there's been a massive surge in the number of chief digital officers in the industry, as people realize that the next big sort of wave is to be successful, is that we have to have a unified digital teams. And it's not, you know, business and technology aren't separate things, they're the same thing. And technology was something that was provided for a business. That's vastly different than technology being the business. And I'm excited at seeing the impact of chief digital officers in the industry, but also in the expanding roles of CTOs and, you know, them taking on that function as well, because of the, it is the business. Like, that's the big difference.
No, I've been seeing the rise of the chief digital officer too. And that's definitely the way, I mean, things are going more digital, right? They're not going less digital.
Yeah.
Did you see the Elon Musk interview with Joe Rogan the other day?
No, I'm always scared to watch Elon Musk at the moment. So
there's no weed. He didn't smoke weed on this podcast, on this latest okay. one. But but no, he just talks about how we're already, one thing that's interesting is he talks about like how we're sort of already cyborgs. It's just the bandwidth is really low because we have to type things in, get information and consume it back out. And he says that that's just going to collapse, right? Like it's going to just become closer and closer and closer until it's just, we have the neural links in our head and we can just get the results and communicate how we want. Does that future, does that excite you, terrify you? What are your thoughts on that?
I think there's two phases. There's the initial phase where it terrifies me, and then it excites me. And I can explain a little bit about that. It's, you know, when you start a company, you have immediate alignment, because you're just there by yourself and you have a vision and you have a goal, and everyone just respects the fact that you're not out of business yet, and survival is a huge victory. And the people who join your company, they agree with the idea, and you interview them all yourself, and you build a really cohesive early culture, and the world doesn't change that fast. So you've got 15, 20 people and you're all aligned, and because everybody sort of self-selected in. And when a company gets bigger, that starts to drift because you have more people. And the best description I saw of this is a company's culture has to shift from tribal to the customer at some point, because you need something external to align a larger organization. And if you try to maintain that tribal instinct, it's really doesn't respect people's agency. It doesn't respect that people are different. It doesn't respect different ideas. But what's interesting from a leadership perspective, that where everybody just agreed with you because they joined because they agreed with you, now you're shifting and your goal is cultivating alignment. And you know, you're putting together teams and practices and plans and measurements that get everyone focused on the external goal and on the customer and on the strategy. And alignment is the goal. It's a drift away from, you know, sort of the initial shared idea. It's now shared goals. When I think about technology, sorry, this is a little bit of a long setup.
No, keep going.
Things fragment really, really quickly in a culture because everybody has great ideas and there's so much information out there. And you see it in our culture now, in North America in particular, the polarization of political views and thinking and practices. And, you know, being able to focus on a few things that are aligned with your goals is very profound from a human sort of health and mental wellness. And you know, it's about your identity. It's about your focus. It's about where you put your energy. If you're always trying to figure out everything all the time, you start to develop a lack of focus, and you end up with anxiety because you're just trying to find a common picture in a soup of ideas. And to me, that's what digital is. That's what the news is now, because it's, you know, the clickbaity aspect of it, the algorithms driving content. It's not actually driving strong human outcomes. When you think about a team and you think about a goal and you think about how you work, you know, I would fully support someone hiring a company that does waterfall project delivery, because there is a need for that kind of work in certain types of industries with certain types of human sort of risk factors and whatnot. But Wrangle is not interested in that because that's not who we are, right? We are focused on a particular market segment. We provide lean agile solutions and a continuous delivery partnership model to create customer experience centric outcomes for companies that don't have those capabilities themselves. That doesn't mean that's the only way of doing things, but it allows everybody to focus on that. And that means we get to keep our sanity. We get to be innovative. We get to be creative. We get to create real value. We get to help our clients. And we know where we stand. As soon as you have technology guiding you, you just don't have an environment that is sane, really. So taking that a little further, so we improve the bandwidth from our digital. And, ultimately, what I think we need is something that understands, more of the human spirit and the human mind and the importance of how we do storytelling. And how we think about things. And we need to curate our experiences. And, we've traditionally curated our experiences through art and culture. And I found, in a very interesting way, I've become much more passionate about things, maybe because I'm getting older, I don't know, but things that are human, that have art, that have, the human spirit, I find that helps because that allows me to orient on purpose and orient on things outside. Otherwise, we just start, reacting to everything. So I think it's going to be terrible at first. And we need to find, and I think we're getting better. People have recognized the issues with social media and whatnot. But there's probably going to be this period where you almost want to stay somewhat disconnected until it's good enough to be connected again, because it's going to be not very human and not very effective until the technology is good enough that we can create the technology to support us in a more human way. So I could see AI becoming effective in, not in sort of brainwashing us, but curating our experiences so we can, live in a focused way as opposed into a manipulated sort of random way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I brainwash myself, right? Like what I choose to curate in my environment is performing that outcome of brainwashing, right? If I surround myself with, leadership books or people who are motivated and people who are changing the world, that has a direct impact on my thoughts and my behaviors and my actions and my future.
Yeah. And I guess what I worry about is we lose that, right? That control, because we're now getting so much information that's coming, at us, that's being curated for us, and we're not in control.
And that's where that little laser beam of focus comes in. And so I'm always trying to figure out, if I just did one thing today that would move me forward towards one of my goals, what would that be? I also started waking up in the morning and making goals for the year, but only about three. And they're kind of big. By the way, getting good at goal making is really hard. I mean, I've been working at this for years and I've tried all these different styles and methodologies and different things. And I've kind of figured out what works for me, but I put together these macro goals. I want to improve my health. And then I just ask myself, what's one thing today that I'm going to do to move that goal forward? And then I'm only ever working with three goals. I want, my business to be profitable to a certain dollar amount. Okay. That's my goal for 2020. I just now I have freedom. What projects am I going to execute against, or what can I do today to just put me in a better position, reduce my probability of failure against achieving it? And I found that works because I'm a pretty creative person. And so that gives me these cement pillars to orbit around, to anchor myself on, so I know I'm moving myself forward on a life path. But at the same time, I get creativity to how am I going to chip away at that every day.
Yeah, I like that. Similar experience. It's ultimately it's about what works for each individual and the way that your mind is wired. So, my wife, she looks at my sort of enthusiasm for planning tools and task management and things. And she just sort of looks at me like I'm crazy, because she just writes down a simple list of what she needs to do. She does it, and then she continues. But I tend to have a lot of diverse interests, and I get distracted fairly easily, and I don't have the same attention span that she has. So, so I try to do these lists, but these lists tend to get out of control, and then I sort of declare list bankruptcy and I'll start again. And that was what happened, you know, for a number of years. So, I found out that, going with less is very helpful, and I had to really, I love information and I love learning, but I got very, very disciplined at not collecting things and being very comfortable at just deleting things and reducing the clutter. And so I have a discipline now where I have less clutter, mental planning sort of initiatives, and get down to a few things that are really the key things that I need to focus on. And don't let myself get distracted by anchoring on that. I started doing 70-day plans. Where I focus on a few things for 70 days, and I pick 70 days based upon the, 60 days, 66 days for a habit. And that's where I didn't drink, between first, it was 70 days, it was 10 weeks. And I just sort of loaded that up and figured I'd run with that. And then at the end of the 70 days, see what I've learned and certain things become habit. And then I roll into the next. So that's how I started meditating again last summer. And I've done it continuously now since then. I took up cycling because I had a foot injury. I couldn't run for a while. So I took up cycling and, I focused on that, and that became sort of ingrained in my habit. So a lot of focus also on pushing things into the habit space, so I don't actually have to think about it and exercise my willpower.
Isn't that amazing how that works? Especially as I'm getting older, I realize I can get things programmed. I look at myself as a computer, and I'm like, I can program things into me, and then they get done without me thinking about them.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating, and and things that were tiring aren't tiring anymore because they're just instinctive. And if it's instinctive, it's just a much different impact on our brain and our willpower. Like it becomes free from a willpower perspective, which is a huge, huge win. And when you think of all the things that we have to do in life and all the things we have to focus on, if something can become sort of automatic, then it frees up our capacity to tackle other higher value things.
It's like programming. Like the work is writing the program. And once it's written, it operates.
It is. And it's actually one of the things I'm really excited about. So from an organizational perspective, the ability to focus and, what it's talking about, but from a personal perspective, there's a lot of similar concepts. And I read Thinking Fast and Slow last year by Daniel Kahneman. And I've just been seeing the whole world through this System 1, System 2 filter since. And it's been pretty fascinating. And the concept of biases and recency bias, availability bias. He did a great podcast with Tyler Cohen on noise, and he actually states in it that he thinks noise is a more profound challenge for humans than bias. And most of Thinking Fast and Slow is about cognitive bias. So he has another book that'll be coming out sometime this year, I think, on noise. So I'm pretty excited about that. But that concept of programming ourselves is actually really, I think, resonates well when you read that book. Because once things become available, we just they're the things that shape our worldview. So by making something else a little stronger in our minds, or hacking our minds, so to speak, then we can, or using other framing tools, we can perceive and see things differently. So it speaks to a healthier sort of mind and a self-understanding that gives us a better maybe more tolerance and better instincts around differing point of views.
How would I find that podcast you mentioned?
It's on noise. So Daniel Kahneman, noise, and Tyler Cohen, Cowen.
Awesome. I'm going to listen to that, because that's a good way for me to describe the difference between before having my diet the way it was and after. Is it was a profound experience where the best way to describe it was things just quieted down. It was like a clarity or just like a noise, like a signal versus noise. It's like somebody just turned the white noise down. It's like somebody's like, yeah. here's a knob. I'm just going to turn the white noise down. And I was like, well, biologically, with my limited medical understanding, if your body is like fighting itself, right? And that's creating a lot of, that's like a sub process running that's taking up the memory. And if you just kill that thing, right, it frees up the memory and you have more working memory, you have more clarity, you can enjoy life more. And I haven't even like stacked more things on my to-do list. For me, it's just been like enjoying my overall experience. Like I'm just going through, you know, this past week with just more memory, like just a better, clearer feeling while I do the things that I already know drive revenue and create results.
That's great.
Yeah. My instinct was to pile a bunch of new stuff on. And I was like, no, I get so unhappy when I do that, you know?
So I started a new habit earlier this week, and it's sort of interesting because you lose certain momentum or you get tired of something. So I used to come home at night and I'd watch a couple of TED Talks. That's what I would do. So I wouldn't watch a TV show. I'd watch a couple of TED Talks. Then I stopped. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to go make lunch because I'm at home like everyone else. So what I do is I fire up a TED Talk because you can listen to a lot of them. And then what I do is I just sort of cook and listen. And then I go and, watch the rest of it while I eat. They're about 18 minutes. So I'm done and I've got some sort of insight. And what I found, I was talking about this a little earlier, is it just starts surfacing my creativity because it links to my other experiences and it creates an external sort of focus. You know, it gets me out of my head, out of just thinking about the business, thinking about Wrangle, and it opens up my creativity and my passion for things. So, the one I was listening to today was an amazing talk about storytelling and someone who got hired to run storytelling workshops for medical students and doctors. And what they found was that it had a tremendous impact on mental wellness because it would get people to sort of share with other people and sort of connect with other people, understand other people had similar challenges, but also more have people remember, the purpose behind what they're doing and the value and getting that reinforcement. And so it was interesting. It was a fascinating talk. And then there was a one right after I ended up watching too, and it was on mental wellness and teaching. And so, with COVID, we hear a lot about frontline workers and the impact on them. Doctors have that all the time, and it's actually pretty stunning when you hear about the impact on doctors, their mental sort of wellness and just a regular sort of environment. And then teachers as well, who are continuously, responsible for educating these other humans, and those humans come in with all their other sort of challenges in life and the impact there. So it's just a really inspiring but also humanizing couple of talks.
That's a good point you just brought up. I'd say there's the change or the evolution in the business world today is like, we have underperforming people who normally perform pretty well. It's common knowledge, or at least it's penetrating the common knowledge, that we would, talk to them like a human and figure out like what's going on, like as part of our diagnosis process, just be real with them. And that just drew a parallel to like, what do teachers do when they have an eighth or a 12th grade student, or maybe a college kid? Like, are they getting involved on that level? I'm curious now.
It really depends on the teacher, and even if they're not, they're still like the one talk I saw today was, you just still absorb it, right? So, and you absorb it, and you can't not, right? And so it was pretty touching on and I never really thought about it from a teacher that is really seeing that year after year after year, all those stories, all those people, all those victories and all those challenges, and the toll and the impact is and how do they maintain their sort of mental wellness in that kind of an environment, and doctors as well. So
this is great. What's like the big call to action that your customers respond to, or how they find you?
So there's two different areas right now. So I talked about our start and putting together these customer experience application teams. That's often how they find us, because they're trying to build something and they find us and they like how we talk about it, and they reach out and we work with them or we meet them at a show. I talked a lot about, linking the organization and creating the ability to, build and ship customer experiences without getting stuck in the organizational friction. And so we've been doing a lot of work in design systems lately. And design systems are an integrated sort of strategy, design, and development platform where you capture as much of the strategy, the design, the brand, and you create a single source of truth so that your front-end customer experience teams can actually problem solve. And I think the need to get customer-centric, and companies just can't do that, that's where we're really looking to partner with our clients. You want to get customer-centric, you need to find a way to create front-end customer-centric teams that have the ability to problem solve. And that is the biggest challenge in organizations, because there are so many walls that go from budgeting and strategy and design and governance. By the time there's a team building something, almost all of their ability to make a decision has been removed, and they don't even know why certain things exist. So over-planning paralyzes teams. You need to create teams that have a goal, and they need to be able to chase that goal, but that's hard in a enterprise. And so using design systems and lean agile practices and front-end teams and continuous delivery, we're partnering with our clients to fix that.
Excellent. So we'll put links in the show notes, and the website is just wrangle.io.
Yep.
Excellent. Is there anything else that we need to cover we didn't get off today?
Yeah, I actually had one prepared answer.
Yeah.
So if I could go back in time, what would I tell a younger version of myself? So, when you're younger, it's all about sort of figuring it out. And especially if you're coming at it from a technology perspective, it's an invention thing. And, and everybody sort of knows this if you've been involved with any kind of startups. And it's like, no, it's not an invention thing. It's a team thing. And if I were to give myself advice, a younger version of myself, seize the opportunities to develop leadership skills earlier, in addition to your sort of, technology and consulting skills, because, ultimately, it's not just about an idea. It's not just about an invention. It's not about problem solving. It's about working with other people and executing on something. And I think almost any company can be successful if they can find better ways to execute and deliver more value. And almost any startup can succeed, if they can, survive long enough to find the market that probably exists for their idea. And that's leadership, that's team building. And that's something that I was pretty oblivious to until probably, I'm not even going to embarrass myself by saying when, but I'll say in my 30s, I started getting a little more sort of aware, because up to that, I was just too busy learning about the work I did. And I never spent enough time learning about people. And that's the advice I'd give my younger self.
Amazing. Well, you're killing it today, my friend. Beautiful company, growing, building cool products. I'm really happy to know you and get to spend some time with you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the talk as well. It was inspiring for me. I was good to hear your story, and I'm going to see about getting myself tested for food sensitivities.
I would definitely do that. I think any human should do that.
Right.
All right.
Awesome.
Talk soon.
Talk soon.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.